week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Koh, your host, and once again, thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we have Gretchen Rubin joining us. Most of you have heard of Gretchen Rubin for her very, very popular book, The Happiness Project. She also has several other New York Times bestsellers. Her latest book, Better Than Before, Happier at Home. She also has a top podcast. You should check it out, Happier with Gretchen Rubin. It is a podcast where she discusses good habits and happiness with her sister, Elizabeth Kraft. I had so much fun on this podcast because Gretchen came in and laid out habits. I've had such an issue with this in the past. People ask me all the time, hey, Laura, you know, you've been a successful entrepreneur, you've written a book. How do I structure my day? How do I stay organized? And I do think there's a couple things to do that are just, you know, easy. But as far as wake up in the morning at 5 a.m. and then go for a jog and then and meditate, I just don't ever feel like there's a one-size-fits-all answer. And Gretchen comes in and she crushes this question. I love it. It's essentially the answer is you got to do it in a way that works for you and let go of this prescriptive model that there is a one-size-fits-all way of setting up habits in your life. Most of us are failing because we're not being honest about what works for us. Gretchen lays this out, and I'm telling you, really worth tuning in. If you're interested in finding out more about Gretchen, she has a new book about tendencies coming out. You can take a quiz on those tendencies. I did. Turns out I'm a questioner. We talk about those tendencies, also very, very informative. All of her information, GretchenRubin.com. Her books, her manifesto, any information you want. Of course, we'll list everything on our podcast page, lauracoh.com/podcast. You'll find Gretchen Rubin, links to all the resources from today's episode and everything else that you could be interested in. Again, thank you for tuning in. And if you have any questions, anything you want me to speak to, send me a note, laura@lauracoh.com. I love hearing from each and every one of you. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I am Laura, your host, and I am so excited to have our guest on today. Most of you will know the name just because it's hard not to, in this space, bump into something Gretchen has done. She has got an incredible amount of amazing work out there. But Gretchen Rubin is here to join us to talk about her latest work and her story. So hi, Gretchen. Thank you so much for coming on.
I'm so happy to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
I am likewise so excited to hear more about your story and all of these incredible books. I have to be honest, you know, most of us have heard Gretchen Rubin, The Happiness Project, huge success, millions of copies sold. I had no idea, though, that you've actually written 8 books. That's incredible.
Yeah. No, it's one of those things where you're like, it took me 10 years to be an overnight success or something. Yeah, people... I have written many a book, some which had a bigger splash than others, but all were so fun to write. I love them all. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think that's what I wanted to kind of, you know, there's so much where we look at people's highlight reels, right? And we see this one thing. I sold a company and people are like, oh my God, you sold a company. I'm like, yeah, after 10 years of sweating it out, like, you know, it's just brutal to get there. So yeah, if you could take us back a little bit, you know, I was just fascinated to find out, and I don't know how many people out there have heard your story, but you were a lawyer first, you were clerking for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. How do you go from what is seemingly this incredible position to saying, you know, I want to go do something completely polar opposite, go become a writer and start writing, you know, this incredible body of work?
Well, it's interesting because like a bunch of things happened at about the same time that I think helped me make the jump. So I was clerking on the Supreme Court, which is an amazing job. I do not regret it for an instant. It was fantastic. And you're there with all these other clerks who are clerking for your justice or other justices. And one of the things that I realized was these people truly loved law. Like they wanted to talk about it in the cafeteria at lunchtime and they were reading law journals on the weekend. Like they loved it. And I realized that I did what I had to do an excellent job for Justice O'Connor, but I didn't want to spend one more minute on it. And so I realized there's something different about me from these other people. And since then, I will say that is a very important thing to notice about yourself. Do you enjoy shop talk? If you enjoy shop talk, that means you enjoy your job. I now, all I want to do is talk shop.
Oh my God, Gretchen, I got to interject here. I mean, so I was an entrepreneur in healthcare and my brother would read the books and he cared we were business partners. And I just was like, I'd rather read anything than the topic I was in, right? That's such a huge tell sign. And for some reason, I just blew right past it.
Yeah. No, it's like my husband just like all he loves to do is talk shop. And it's, so anyway, that's an important thing. So that happened. And then I went over to a friend's house and she was in education graduate school. And she had, this was in Washington, D.C. And she had like a really big, boring looking book on her coffee table. And in a very dismissive way, I said something like, oh, is this the kind of thing you have to read for your program? And she said, oh, yeah, but that's the stuff I read on my own anyway. So again, I was like, I want my job to be what I would do on my own anyway. And hey, big important clue, in my free time, I was researching this giant project. Now, this is something that happens to be true about me. I will often get really interested in subjects and read a ton about them, basically for no good reason. Like right now, I'm obsessed with color. And I cannot even tell you how much I read about color to no apparent end. Like it has nothing to do with anything that I write about professionally. I just, so this is something that happens to me throughout my life. So I was
color, like literally, yeah,
literally color,
like what we see or like different types of color.
Okay. What we see,
how it works, like from the
signature
rods and
not the rods and cones. Anyway, don't get me started on color because I will not stop.
Okay.
But so at this point, I had had this moment when I was like out of my lunch hour. I like went for a walk. I was gazing up at the Capitol Dome. And I said to myself, what am I interested in that everybody in the world is interested? And I thought, power, money, fame, sex. And it came to me in that phrase, power, money, fame, sex. And that eventually became my first published book, which is called Power, Money, Fame, Sex, A User's Guide. But at that moment, I just realized it hit me like a lightning bolt, this idea of this subject, this linked subject, power, money, fame, sex, the worldly passions. And I went on this gigantic research project. I would stay late at work. At this time, there was no internet. I date myself. And so but I could run free LexisNexis searches, which is like the precursor to using the internet. Right. So I could have this giant database. Turns out if you're a Supreme Court justice, you actually can check out books from the Library of Congress. Everybody else has to just go like read them in the Library of Congress, but a Supreme Court justice can take them home. So I would check out the craziest books under Justice O'Connor's name and what they thought Justice O'Connor, like one of my favorite books, which this is an amazing book, is called Deep in the Heart of Texas, The True Story of Three Sisters Who Are All Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders. Fascinating, fascinating meditation on the nature of fame. So I was doing this huge research project. I was working on the weekends. I was working at night. And then I thought, you know, finally it hit me. This is what people do who are going to write a book. And right. Writing a book is something that some people get paid to. It's their job. I'm treating this like my hobby, but this could also be my job. And my sister is a she was a professional writer before I was. She's a TV writer, but she had been writing kind of pulp fiction for teenagers at that point. So somebody very close to me was a professional writer. And so at a certain point, I was like, you know, I would rather fail as a writer than succeed as a lawyer. My husband and I were going to move after my clerkship. We were going to move from Washington to New York. And I was like, if I get a law job, I may never try this. This is my moment. This is like, there's an obvious transition point. I have an idea, you know, just try it. And my husband was switching out of law too. So we were like, we're not paying our bar fees anymore. You know, it was sort of like, and so I got a book called How to Write and Sell Your Nonfiction Book Proposal and Followed the Directions. That's what I did. Yeah.
I love what you just said. I'd rather fail as a writer than be successful as a lawyer. I mean, what a really like, if you really think about that, right? I mean, follow your passions and fail and just sort of come to terms with the fact that that's more important to you than the quote unquote success, even if you're not, you know, enjoying the process.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say two things that I think made it easier for me. One is I think very often people know what they don't want, but they don't know what they do want. And that's very difficult and painful. And I was lucky in that I knew what I wanted. And that was pulling me forward with an almost irresistible. Once I had the idea, it was like I could not help myself. I felt so compelled to do it. So that made it easier. Plus, everybody in my life was super supportive of it. My parents, who had just, by the way, paid for law school, were totally like, oh, okay, you want to start off again from nothing with not a clip, not a contact, not a nothing. Fine. Yeah, cool. Like I was lucky because a lot of people, out of so much love, really want people to be safe. They don't want them to fail. They don't want them to take risks. And so I was lucky that my husband, my parents, my sister, they were all like, you know,
supportive and in there. And
yes,
yeah, that's huge because, you know, the projections that parents place on their children and you know, these visions of grandeur that they have, that this is somehow a narcissistic extension of themselves, right? It's bad and it can be stifling. So it's totally fair point. And so you went ahead and wrote a couple books. And what was it that sort of got you to write The Happiness Project? Where did that book come from?
Well, I was just finishing up my biography of John F. Kennedy, and there's periods, it's less so now when there's so much work for writers to do with social media and everything. But at that time, you had this sort of down period where you had basically written a whole book, but it hadn't hit the shelves yet. And so it's just sort of like this open period of thinking. And I was stuck on a bus on a rainy day, and I was just like had this random thought. I thought, well, what do I want from life anyway? I want to be happy. And I thought, well, that's kind of funny because I never think about whether I am happy or if I could be happier. I never think about it. So I thought, you know, I should have a happiness project. And that was the phrase that I thought of, a happiness project. So like I said, I get it's very common for me to get like really obsessed with an idea. So I went, ran to the library, got this giant stack of books about happiness and just started researching it for myself. I was just curious, like, what is happiness? Can you make yourself happier? What does the science show? What do the great minds from history show? And I was reading and taking notes, which is something that I do all the time. But it was like, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's such a gigantic, fascinating subject that at a certain point, I was like, wow, maybe this isn't just a passing obsession, which I will enjoy and then sort of outgrow. Maybe this should be my next book. And so that's what happened. It started out just for me.
So yeah. Even like with 8 books, I mean, you're basically saying that there are a bunch of these obsessive focus topics that you will dive into and they don't become books. You just research them.
Oh, no. Yeah. Most of them don't. No. Or they become slight thing. Like I was very, very interested in pain, chronic pain. That figures in happiness, certainly, but it's like never really developed. I'm obsessed with St. Therese of Lisieux, who's my spiritual master, even though I'm not even Catholic. I have read I'm like an expert on St. Therese. Like I have read every book about St. Therese. I have very, very strong feelings about St. Therese. I can barely hold myself back from writing a biography about it, but nobody wants to hear what I have to say about St. Therese. You know, so no, this happens to me. It's kind of, I used to try to restrain it because I was like, this isn't professional. Like my research, reading, note-taking time is like, that's all I have. That's my asset. That's my work. But then I was like, you know what? Just who knows what, like this with the Happiness Project, it ended up being like the best thing that ever happened to me professionally. And if I had tried to squelch it thinking like this is a digression from what I should be thinking about, I might never have done it. So now I kind of just let the kite, you know, fly out and just see what happens.
Yeah, because I mean, there's no way to tell people.
No.
Ask me, you know, when I had this company and it was very successful, did I know? You kind of know that there's something there, but it doesn't mean that it's going to blow up at some point.
Yeah. You just really don't know how things are going to work out.
And so
it's fun.
You made a comment like in passing, and I just want to go back to it that, you know, things used to be different with the publishing industry, and nowadays, you know, it's moved. What are your thoughts? I mean, I've come into the publishing industry, you know, as it's moved over, but, you know, there was sort of classic publishing. You get a book deal and you have this process and then you go back and do it again. Now it's brand and social media and, you know, Twitter accounts and Facebook. How do you think about all of that?
Well, you know, it's really different for every writer because every writer, talk about authenticity, like everybody feels differently about these things. Mm-hmm. Some people really take to it. Some people really don't like it. Some people, their subject really lends itself to it. And some people, they don't. Like, I wrote a biography of Winston Churchill. That was like one of the highlights of my whole life. What a subject. What a book to write. I loved it, loved it, loved it. It does not lend itself to social media the way something like happiness does. Right. You know what I mean? So some people, it's just whatever. And then some people, it's their audience. Like you might have an audience that is really like, if you are on Instagram, you're going to find your audience there. And you love Instagram. And so it's a great way for you to connect. Other people, it's not so clear how that works. And so I think it's very specific to a particular person's subject, audience, everything. I will say that for me, some writers, and this is less true than it used to be, but some writers really used to look at it as a distraction. Like it was taking them away from their real work. And they also felt like it was an imposition. It was like extra credit that the teacher was assigning, but it wasn't like helping your grade.
Right. It's like, oh my God, I have to go over to Twitter now, but I really should be focused on my work.
Well, and also for writers who make their living, it's sort of like, this is how I make my living. I don't want to do all this stuff for free because that's how I make my living. And so, and also like, oh, you're telling me I need to have a website. Well, that costs me. Uh-huh. I have to design it and run it and pay somebody to update it and everything. Like I'm actually paying money for something that is not like whatever.
So this used to be like this podcast. I mean, it's completely free and it costs.
Yes.
Yeah.
It costs you money, time, energy, and money for all the infrastructure. But I think now people feel they see the value of it. They see that you need to get yourself out there. But for me, I'm really fortunate because my subject, so much of my learning is anecdata. It's like so many people will say to me, I've experienced this, or like with my next book, which is called The Four Tendencies, which is about this personality framework that I came up with or that I discovered that divides all of people into four categories. One of the reasons that I understood it was I kept noticing that people would say this following thing. I don't believe in New Year's resolutions. If something's important to me, I'll do it right away. I won't wait for January 1st because January 1st is an arbitrary date. And it was like they'd all read that off some sheet. And I'm like, that's so interesting because the arbitrariness of January 1st doesn't bother me. But for these people, that was like deal breaker. They hated that. And so that, like, so just for me, hearing what people say, hearing their experiences, hearing their questions, their observations, how they take an idea and apply it in their own life. I mean, I see things in such a different, you know, people talking about like, oh, you talk about this to make your marriage happier. Well, this worked for me, this worked for me, this worked for me. Well, that's really valuable information for me. So I think some writers with their subject, they're not really getting that much from it. I benefit enormously in terms of my own work. And so for me, it's like, it's so valuable. Personally, I don't struggle with that because I'm like, it's, I totally think it's worthwhile for me and I enjoy it. But you're right. It's a new thing for writers. Now, one thing I would say to somebody, if you're in that situation, because a lot of people will say to me, kind of like criticizing me backhand, they'd be like, oh, well, you know, I can't do that because I can't just brag on myself all the time, or I just can't self-promote all the time. And I will say, one of the most satisfying things about it is not the self-promotion, but the opportunity to shine a spotlight on someone whose work you value. I mean, like you have your podcast. It's like, it's, you can say like, this is great. Like I got obsessed with this book, Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. This novel that I think, I was just like, this is such a great novel. If you look on my blog, I've talked about this book like five times because I'm like, you should go read Tale for the Time Being. It's such a great novel. That is not, you don't have to talk about yourself all the time. No, you shouldn't talk about yourself all the time. Talk about other people's stuff.
Yeah, that's
talk
such about a good
interesting,
point.
Talk about interesting ideas or things that cause your attention or counterintuitive principles or something. Like shine a spotlight on other people. And then people are like, ooh, this person has like cool ideas and is a trusted resource. I want to like learn more about where they're coming from. And it feels good. Feels good.
Yeah. So that's so funny. You're making me think like I was obsessed with Krishnamurti for a little while. And I was like, I've written like four blog posts on this. This is crazy.
Yes.
But yeah, it's like you can share what you've taken the time to, you know, I'm kind of your opposite. I don't read en masse like that. I take like a very small book, like, you know, where each sentence is painful to read. And I just percolate and think about it for half a year.
There you go.
Yeah. But I get obsessed with it. I love that. I love that. And so your latest book, Better Than Before, it's all about habits, right? And there, I was so excited to talk about this because I, you know, in authenticity and all the work I've done, I've thought about habits, BJ Fogg, Power of Habits, all this stuff is out there. And, you know, I want to get to it in a minute with these tendencies, but why habits? Like what got you to think about it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, why this particular book?
Well, you know, I'd been talking to people about happiness for years and I'd been researching it relentlessly. And what I realized is that a lot of times when people often know how they could be happier. It's not like it's a big mystery to them. They're like, I would be happier if I exercised. I would be happier if I quit sugar. I would be happier if I wrote that novel in my free time. I would be happier if I got more sleep. I'd be like, in my sister's case, I would be happier if I quit Candy Crush. Why can't I? Why don't I? Like, what's the deal?
Right.
And I realized what it was is it was a problem of habit formation. That very often these were habits that people wanted to form. The habits would make them happier. The research was there and they knew it to themselves. And yet they were unable to form a habit. And so I became very drawn to understanding the role that habits can play in helping us be happier, healthier, more creative, more productive. So I got drawn into it. But then, okay, what I found, which to my surprise, like what I say is truly revolutionary, but it's so obvious that nobody even notices that it's revolutionary because when I say it, you're like, well, of course that's true. But by the way, nobody else says this. If you look at almost all the habit experts out there, they're like, this is the answer. I'm going to tell you what to do. You're going to start small. You're going to give yourself a cheat day. You're going to do it for 30 days. You're going to do it first thing in the morning. And I am here to tell you, maybe, maybe not, because there is no one magic one size fits all solution. And to this idea of authenticity with habit formation, this is crucial. You have to do it in the way that's right for you because you, Laura, could be a night person and I'm a morning person. Or you, Laura, could be a moderator and I'm an abstainer. Or you could be a finisher and I'm an opener. Or you might be an abundance lover and I'm a simplicity lover. And so the way you set up your running habit or your writing your novel habit or whatever might be completely different from the way that would work for me. Not because you're right and I'm wrong or I'm right and you're wrong, because we're different. And so different, there's a million ways to set these habits up. But very often people are like, I should be able to do it this way. This way worked for my sister-in-law. If I can't do it this way, I'm lazy. I have no willpower. Okay, so fine, I'm giving up.
Oh my God, Gretchen, like, can we just put in an amen? Because I, you know, I coach people on this and people want to feel more authentic, which is also another way of saying they want to feel better, happier. But habits comes up, right? And there's a mindset out there. And I'm so glad. I'm going to start literally giving your book out to everybody because...
Excellent.
I felt this instinct, like I hear people saying it over and over. I should get up at 5 a.m. I should meditate. I should do transcendental meditation 2 times a day, or I should. I'm like, I kept thinking, why? Like, I'm a certain way. It works for me. I am an abstainer. Thank you for explaining that to me. I mean, when I had a health issue, I was able to go off sugar, grains, and dairy for 5 years without a problem, just because it was like a all or nothing mindset. But if you told me to lose 5 pounds just because, I can't do it, you know? But knowing that there's these differences and you've put language around them, I think this is brilliant, because people, you know, there are so many ideas out there. BJ Fogg, just anchor it to something small. It doesn't work for me.
No, because for a lot of people starting small works, it's like these little accomplishments, you make room for it. But a lot of people, they just lose interest. Like, they want something big and bold. That's what's going to excite them. That's what's going to keep them going. And like incremental change, they're just like, it's just not even worth fussing with.
Me, that's fine. Totally. I'm my hands up in the air. I don't care.
Yeah. It's like, they're both right. Yes. It's like, whatever works for you. And to say, and I just worry whenever you should be, if this is important to you, you should be able to do this. It's like, well, there's a lot of ways I could achieve that aim. I don't think I mean, I'm an abstainer. I don't eat carbs basically, except for like nuts and vegetables. So, you know, I don't eat sugar. And people will often say to me, like, you should be able to have a brownie. You should be, you're too rigid. You should be able to do this. I'm like, not eating brownies makes me so much happier than eating brownies ever did. So why should I?
Right.
You know, like, people will literally tell me it's unhealthy. I'm like, you can say many things and you can talk about your own experience, but you can't tell me that I would be healthier if I ate brownies. Like, this is not true. This is not the case, but there's this feeling like there's a right way and a wrong way. And you're the one who has to get with the program. And so what I found is, and maybe you've seen this too, is that a lot of times when people try and fail over and over and they get very discouraged and they feel like failures, I'm just like, it's not, there's anything wrong with you. You just set this up the whole wrong way. I'm like, I had a friend of mine, such a nice person. I mean, I've known him since college. He is such a nice person. And he looked me in the eye and said, my New Year's resolution is to get up early every day and go for a run. And I'm like, I'm sorry, have you met yourself? Because no, you won't. I'm just saying that right now. I don't want to be discouraging or fatalistic, but that's just not going to work for you. You should go running at 4.
But
because
Gretchen,
you're an ape.
Why do we care if it works that way? Why do we care if we get it done the way somebody else gets it done?
I think because people really want there to be one right way. Mm-hmm. And you see somebody else has a success. Like, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, I see that this person I know wrote her novel, or she finished her PhD thesis in a year, or, you know, you're like, well, that worked for her, therefore it will probably work for me. So what I try to do in Better Than Before is really just, and you mentioned like having language. And I think a lot of times it's that we don't have language around things. So it's hard to talk about it. So for a way this comes up a lot in work is abundance lovers and simplicity lovers. You just think whatever's true for you is kind of universally true for everyone else. This is just sort of human nature. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get a boss who walks around the office saying things like, a cluttered desk is a cluttered mind. And you need to have just like one sheet of paper, and that's the way to do it. And you've got too many icons on your desktop, and you need to, you know. And it's like, I get that because I'm a simplicity lover, you know, and that's the way that I work. But then there are abundance lovers, and they like buzz and profusion and choices and stuff on the walls and things happening. And it's not that one way's right and one way's wrong. It's just that one way works for you and one way works for me. Now, if we have to share a space, we may have to have that discussion. But it's much easier to say, like, as a simplicity lover, I find all this stuff in this office very overwhelming. I'm wondering if we can dial it back. That's easier than being like, you can't possibly have a clear thought. There's junk everywhere. You need to get this out of here because all the, you know, and that's also like pointing to successful people. There's an amazing book by Mason Curry called Daily Rituals. And he goes through the daily habits of like,
I love that book.
And what you see is like, some people work all the time and some people hardly work. Some people stay up all night. Some people get up at dawn. Some people, you know, are drinking coffee all day. Some people are drinking vodka all day. I mean, there's a million ways. It's like, so what is the answer? Find the way that works for you.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell did a great episode on his podcast about genius. And there's the geniuses that have a flash and it comes to them. And in a week, they have this, you know, Cezanne or somebody has a work for that we appreciate for forever. And then there's Hallelujah, that song. And it went through like several years of iterations, right? So that there's no specific way to really do this. You have to figure out what works for you.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, so, you know, I'm a simplicity person. I can't stand clutter. My partner is an abundance person. She, every single wall is covered with something. If it was up to her, the entire house would be, right? So finding that balance, but not saying you're wrong. And then the deeper point, right, is you can have success either way. You will find more success because that's what people are looking for. They want the habits so they can get the success, but they believe there's a right way. And they're trying to find the prescription model, but it's more you're suggesting figure out who you are and then working within that framework.
Yes. And here's an interesting exercise if you're trying to learn. I mean, obviously in my book, I try to point out a ton of these things. But one thing to do with yourself is to say, was there a time in my life when I had success with this habit, with this aim? Like maybe you want to cook more. Was there a time when you did cook more or you're not making progress on your PhD thesis? Was there a time when you were making progress on your PhD thesis? Because a lot of times like things change in ways that we don't really recognize as being significant to a habit. And so if you think back to a time when you were successful, often there's clues there. So for instance, I talked to a woman who was like, I hate cooking. I want to cook. I know it's healthier. I know it's more economical, but I just hate to cook. But then I was like, well, was there ever a time in your life when you did cook? And she said, oh yeah, you know, actually I lived in a group house in Washington, D.C. And when I was there, I cooked all the time. And I said, well, what was different? And we went through and she was like, what about this? What about this? And then we realized what the difference was actually she doesn't mind cooking. She hated food shopping. And she had a roommate who loved like going to farmers markets and going to a gourmet grocery store and like stopping off and picking something
interesting.
Up. And so they would say like, oh, what do you want to make? And then her friend would do all the shopping and she got a big kick out of it. And so then the friend would, and then the woman I was talking to would cook. So the question was not, how do I make myself cook? It's like, how do I get food into my house without having to worry about it? So it's like, she lived in New York City, so she just got Fresh Direct, which is like grocery delivery. It's like, that's an easy solution. So she hadn't even really understood what her problem was, which was she didn't like food shopping.
Right. And but she probably thought she was lazy, right? Or something's wrong with her.
Yeah, but it wasn't. But so there was this clue. The clue was there a time when you did cook?
I love it.
Or like with exercise, you know, I have my personality framework. And one of the things that I say is that a very large group of people who I call obligers we'll do something if there's a form of outer accountability, but not if there's just inner accountability. And so what you often see with obligers is that if I say, well, when did you successfully exercise? It's like, well, when I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice. Well, that's because you had a team and a coach. Or for years, I had a neighbor and we would go walking every morning with our dogs, but then she moved away. Okay, well, so you needed a partner. Or I had this amazing class where I really was connected with the teacher. And like, if I didn't show up, she would email me. But now like my teacher's gone and I just have like this parade of characters who like, I don't even know their names. They don't know my name. Okay, so you're not getting that outer accountability from the teacher. So how do you fit in that outer accountability? The clue is in the past.
When you
were successful.
And so these are called your tendencies, by the way. I'm a questioner.
Well, I knew you were. Yes, I could tell.
And this was really enlightening because I'd love you to walk through these four tendencies, but your point about figuring out, you know, what specifically works for you in these other ways. But then also, I haven't been doing as much yoga and it turned out that I have to have a deep reason. And when you wrote that, I'm like, oh my God, that's what it was. It really was a huge breakthrough for me. So could you walk everybody through these four different tendencies?
So this is what my book is in September is coming out. It's called The Four Tendencies. It's about this. Most people can tell what they are from a brief description, which I will give, but there is a quiz. If you go to happiercast.com/quiz, you can like take an online quiz that will give you an answer. But most people know what they are pretty quick. So this has to do with how you deal with expectations, how you respond to expectations. And we all face two kinds of expectations. Outer expectations, which is like a work deadline or request from a spouse. And then there are inner expectations like I'm interested in maybe switching careers, or I want to keep my New Year's resolution, or I want to start meditating in the morning. That's my own inner expectation. So there's upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline, they keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what's expected of them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. Next, questioners, which is what you are. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. They hate anything arbitrary, inefficient, or irrational. Like, remember I was talking about the people who didn't like the arbitrariness of January 1st. That's a big tip off of questioners. If you hear the word arbitrary, that is like big, big, big.
Yep.
It's flash a huge sign that it's a questioner. They really don't like things to be arbitrary.
Yeah.
Things like speed limits. How many garments can you take into a dressing room? Often will make a questioner crazy.
Totally. I'm like, did we meet before? Because.
Because very consistent pattern. And so questioners, so they can do anything they decide makes sense. And so in a way, they make everything an inner expectation because the fact that you want me to do this doesn't matter. If I don't think it's a good idea, I'm not going to do it. And questioners, even sometimes questioners can get analysis paralysis because they want to have more and more and more information before they act. And sometimes you just have to act without perfect information or the world just isn't going to give you perfect information.
Right, right.
Then there are obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations. This was the group I was talking about before. They readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So they will meet the work deadline. They will meet the request of the spouse. But when it's just their inner expectation, when, oh, I want to start meditating, I want to start running, they struggle. This is the largest group. This is the largest group. Questioners and obligers are the two biggest group, and obligers is the largest group of all. So you probably are an obliger. Or you have a lot of obligers in your life. Obligers are the rock of the world. They are the people who will come through for you, but they often are very frustrated with themselves because they often don't understand they need this outer accountability. So they're trying to rely on, they're like, oh, I lack motivation, or why can't I put myself first, or I'm never the priority. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's just psychologically, you're just trying to explain the pattern. The pattern is you need outer accountability. Plug that in, and I promise your problem will vanish.
So for them, like getting a coach to, you know, yes. If they want to exercise, they should just pay for that coach. Like that's just, they've got to get
100%.
Yeah.
I actually have an app called the Better App, which is all about the four tendencies. And one of the things that a lot of people do is they're obligers who want to form groups with other obligers for something like writing a PhD thesis or working on a garden or learning a language where they need an accountability of a group. A coach is a great thing. Teacher, thinking about your own duty as a role model for other people. There's a million ways to do it once you realize that's what you need. Because a lot of times obligers don't understand that's what they need. And so it's just like this giant revelation to them to understand, looking back on their past, why did I exercise then and not then? Or why can't I come through for other people and not for myself? It's like, there's nothing wrong with it. This is a very striking pattern. And then rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do, when they want to do it in their own way. If you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. And so this is the smallest tendency, but it's a very conspicuous tendency. And a side note, usually when rebels pair up, either in work or in romance, they almost always are paired with obligers. That's the common pattern. There aren't very many rebels. And obligers hook up the best with everybody. Of the four tendencies are like the type O, which is fitting. That's part of the pattern. And so with rebels, if you're dealing with a rebel, or if you are a rebel, I hear from tons of rebels who are trying to understand, like, if you're a rebel who resists telling yourself what to do, how do you form a habit? That's like a special, it's like a special problem.
Right, because they resist outer.
Yes, they can't put anything on the calendar. They can't be expected to do something. So what do? So I spent a lot of time researching that and talking to rebels about how they manage it. And rebels have all kinds of ingenious solutions about how to manage their rebel tendency and their spirit of resistance.
What's one example of some way to get a rebel to motivate?
Okay. Well, one thing that's important to remember is rebels can do anything they want to do. If they want to do it, they can do it. So if I want to be a big influential force at work, and I know that in order to do that, I'm going to have to go to the 10 a.m. staff meeting every Monday, even though I hate having to do it, I can do it because I want to be big and successful. So I talked to a rebel who worked for Facebook. And I was like, wow, it seems like it would be hard for a rebel to work at Facebook. And he said, but you know what? I want to start my own company. So they're teaching me everything I need to learn. So it's like, you're working for me. So in his mind, he had made that flip. But so they can do anything they want to do. So there's nothing. So you will always find a rebel who can do things that you're like, wow, I wouldn't have thought a rebel could do that because that's what they want. But there are tricks that some use. Like typically for rebels, something like a to-do list doesn't work because the minute something's on the to-do list, they don't want to do it. So like a rebel said, she has a could-do list. It's not what I should do. It's just what I could do. I could do that if I felt like that. It's just like, I'm just writing this down to remind myself. Or sometimes they'll turn things into a game. Like somebody said, she wrote them on slips of paper and put them in a jar. And then she would like pull one out randomly. It's like, ooh, what am I going to do? Like this, you know? And so then it was like a game. Several rebels, this is really surprising to me. Really, this is like deep rebel. They will pretend to be a different person. Like, I don't know why this appeals to rebels, but they will be like, I pretend to be a paid house cleaner. I don't know these people. They're paying me to clean their house. I'm like acting out a role. There's sort of like this playfulness of like I'm acting out. Yeah. And so it's not that rebels can't be hugely successful, because there are many rebels who are hugely successful, but they have to find a way to do it within that tendency and understanding. A lot of times they work for themselves. A lot of times they're attracted to jobs where every day is different. Like somebody was saying that she worked for a restaurant in the restaurant industry. And so every day she would drive to a different restaurant. So it was new people. She could go where she felt like. I feel like driving a long time. I feel like driving a short time. Like, oh, I want to go see these. Like, she had a lot of freedom and a lot of kind of spontaneity and no one looking over her shoulder because she was sort of off on her own. So that was a good, she liked that aspect of her job very much.
So can a type change? Can somebody ever, like a obligator, become a questioner, or is it really fixed?
I really do think that these are genetically hardwired, that we come into the world with them, especially with the extreme personality types, the upholder and the rebel, which are the extreme personality types. They're visible very early. And so I don't think that you do change. I don't think you change over time. I don't think you're one at work and one at home. But what I do think is that with time and experience, we learn to manage the downsides of our tendency and to take advantage of the upsides. So if you don't like an aspect of your tendency, like a lot of times obligers don't like the aspect that they need outer accountability, they just deal with it. Just build in that outer accountability, build in that architecture, and then it becomes invisible, and then you're just doing whatever you want. It's no big deal. Or like, I'm an upholder, which is a very small tendency. And one of the problems with being an upholder is you're really, really good at doing stuff. They're really, really good at execution, because they can do what you want them to do and they can do what they want themselves to do. And so I've learned that I need to be a questioner. I'm married to a questioner and I've really learned from him. And sometimes I will literally ask him, do I have to do this? Should I do this? Because it's too easy for me to be like, yes, I can do that. I will do that. Here I am. I'm halfway through doing that. And I've learned from him, take a step back and say, should I do that? Do I want to do that? Does that need to be done at all? Maybe somebody else should be doing that. For him, it comes naturally. For me, it always takes like a second to remind myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Question. Don't do it automatically. Question.
It's really, again, like really understanding who you really are and making peace with that, but then recognizing there's like the, you know, shadow side to these things, and to not judge it or criticize it, but to actually just try to deal with it in productive ways.
Well, no, and I feel bad because sometimes people will say, well, like, I don't think I should be this. I should be this other thing. How do I become that? I'm like, you know, you get what you get and you don't get upset. Like, just deal with what you are. All of these include hugely successful people and also big losers. There's no magic to being one. And that, you know, they all have their upsides, but they all have their downsides. And so you need to learn how to just manage that. And also, to your point about authenticity, it's very important not to get in the way of other people, because again, back to that idea that like sometimes we just try to make other people do things the way that would work for us. I remember I was speaking to a woman, I was speaking about the four tendencies, and this woman came up to me afterward and she said, oh, I'm going to do something differently because of what you said. I said, what is that? And she said, well, my son wants to go to graduate school and he keeps telling me, hey, mom, I need to take the class to study for the GRE, which is the big test that you take to get into graduate school. And I kept saying to him, no, honey, if it's important to you to do well in the GRE, you can just buy a book and study on your own. Now I realize he's an obliger and he needs the class. And I was like, 100%. If somebody's saying to you, I need accountability, don't insist to them that they don't. She was either a questioner or a upholder.
Yeah.
Who says, like, you don't need that. I studied for the bar on my own. I mean, which is pretty hardcore. Mm-hmm. At the time, I didn't think anything of it. And now I'm like, you know, most people can't do that. And in fact, almost everybody that I knew took a course, like went into a classroom and took a course. And I was like, why would I bother to go to a classroom? That's just like going to take more time.
Yeah.
But it's like, don't get in other people's way. If they say they need something or something's not working for them, say, okay, given what we know about what works for you, how do we set things up for you to succeed? Or given what I know about myself, this is when I succeeded in the past. How can I learn from that? Not tell myself I should be different.
I love it. I love it. Basically, the big message is, you know, don't get in other people's way, because that's who they are. And it's finding systems that work for you, and that all of us can be really successful if we understand how to manage, you know, basically the temperament that we come with. And don't get in your own way, right? Because I can start being very arbitrary because I'm a questioner. Why am I not doing this? I did it before. Well, because I don't have a compelling reason right now. That's why I'm not doing it, right? And that was really enlightening to hear you talk about it that way. And it's like, oh, I just need a compelling reason and then I'll be off to the races. Or some days, just forget it. You know, you don't have a great reason and just, you know, get it done because there's not time to really think about this one.
Well, and one of the things for questioners, which is very poignant, is that they often really struggle in school because they're asked to do something that they think is arbitrary and a big waste of their time, so they don't do it. And so, like, a guy came up to me and goes, I don't understand my son. Like, he's super smart. He does really well on the test, but he refuses to do the homework. And I was like, why doesn't he do the homework? And he says, it's stupid. And he's like, why should I write a book report? Like, they know I read the book. And I'm like, you've got a questioner kid and somebody needs to explain to him why he's doing that. If he understands the academic value of it, then he'll do it. Or you need to say to him, I get you, man. This is a big waste of your time. But if you want to go to the high school that you want to, you're going to need to show them that you can do the homework. So even if you think it's stupid, you want to do it because you want to earn the respect of your teachers, because that's going to give you more choices and let you know what you want. It's not the first order, which is I'm learning. It's the second order of, like, I need to do something in order to get something else that's important to me, which questioners will accept, but with more difficulty. But nobody is telling these children, this is why I'm making you do this. When a kid says to you, why do I have to learn about Mesopotamia? You should tell them, why should they learn about Mesopotamia? They are literally asking you, why should I learn about Mesopotamia? There is an answer to that.
Right.
You know, it's like, you're not just learning about Mesopotamia. You're learning how to analyze. You're learning how to paraphrase. You're learning how to pick out the important words in a text. You're learning about how to put things into historical context. These are skills that will serve you throughout your life. On top of learning about Mesopotamia, you know, there's much more to this assignment than just, like, what was the irrigation system used in Mesopotamia, which they, you know, and then they're satisfied. Then they get it.
Because it pulls it out of the arbitrary and it answers that question. And I swear to God, it's like, you're literally like, you guys, if you haven't gone over the quiz, check it out, because I feel like you're literally describing me to a T. I hated school. If I have a reason, then I'm totally, I actually hated school so much. And then I drove my brother to college and I was like, oh my God, there's a point to all of this. Like, really hit me like a ton of bricks. I came back and I got straight A's and I, like, went bananas, right?
Yeah.
But I just needed that bigger point. And, you know, if you're hanging out with an upholder or an obligator and you're a questioner, then they will think you're crazy. So it depends on what your parents are, probably, and how this all plays out in your homes.
It does. It matters a lot, like, how much you understand. Like, people struggle with rebels a lot because it can be very difficult to be with somebody who, if you ask or tell them to do something, won't do it. And many rebels have said to me, I have a rebel child and I'm really glad that I'm a rebel, because I don't think I would know how to be a parent to a rebel if I didn't understand from the inside how they feel. But I do think that you can be a very effective parent to a rebel, even if you're not a rebel, once you understand, like, how to speak to them in a way, like, even something like, now tell Aunt Jane what a nice time you had. You might think that's just a way of saying that, but that's actually telling somebody what to do. And they might just be like, no, I'm not going to do that. Not because they want to be rude to Aunt Jane, and not because they didn't have a good time, but just because, like, they're not going to do it because you told them to. Maybe they were going to tell Aunt Jane they had a good time anyway, because they're a child who's naturally polite. But when you tell them to do that, then they're going to resist. It's interesting. Like, once you see the tendencies, you see how you might be pushing people's buttons for good or for ill, without meaning to. Like, there's little things that you can do.
And back to this broader point, that because there's so much judgment that if you're not doing it a specific way, you're lazy or you're this or you're, you know, so many judgments that we cast. So you now have this podcast, Happier. By the way, I've been in family business for 15 years. Having fun working with your sister, is that a?
Oh my gosh, it's so fun. It's like the greatest. Yeah.
What was the thought behind the podcast?
You know, it's funny because if you look at my books, The Happiness Project and Happier at Home, it's clear that, like, one of the big kind of unresolved aims of my life was to spend more time with my sister. I live in New York. She lives in LA. So it's hard for us to see each other. And there's a big time difference, which matters when you're, like, trying to call or text or whatever. Plus, she's got this big writing job in Hollywood. So her time is very intense and kind of irregular. And I have my own stuff. And so when it was this idea of having a podcast about how to be happier, I thought, oh my gosh, what would really be great is if I could do it with my sister.
That's awesome.
Because we've always wanted to collaborate and this would be great. And one of the things that's nice is Elizabeth's very different from me. Like, it's clear that we are so close and we love each other, but we definitely have different personalities. And so I think it's good because you can hear how somebody might agree or disagree or struggle with something. You know, like, maybe Elizabeth, it's something that comes easily for Elizabeth that's harder for me, or vice versa. And it's just so much fun. I mean, it is just a joy to do it.
Yet again, it's just doing phenomenally well. I'm in your space. You're sort of in the top five at every moment. So if you guys haven't checked out Happier, go check it out. And so, Gretchen, I ask everybody this question, and you've been studying habits and happiness for quite a while. What then is an authentic life mean to you?
You know, I think that is really at the core. I think that you've put your finger on something that's just absolutely crucial, which is that we can really have a happy life only when it's based on our own values, our own interests, our own temperament. And so as part of the Happiness Project book, I developed my 12 personal commandments, which is a super fun exercise, which is to try to like really think of like the high level aims and values of your life and really distill them into kind of punchy phrases. And the number one personal commandment is to be Gretchen. And of course, everybody has to substitute their own name, but it's this idea that everything comes down to what is true for me. And you think like, what could be easier than knowing yourself? You just hang out with yourself all day long, but it is
hard.
It is really hard. And it's something that takes constant examination. Here's a good tip. Two good tips I have about knowing yourself, because I do. It's so hard, right?
Like, so hard.
It sounds so easy. Oh, be authentic. You're like, oh, that'll come naturally.
I swear to God, I was like, oh, I'm just going to do this in a minute. Carl Jung says it's a privilege of a lifetime to find out who you really are, right?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Yeah.
Because you're so distracted by who you wish you were or who other people want you to be.
Yeah.
So two questions I think are really helpful is to say, like, what did you like to do when you were 10 years old? Because one thing I see in happiness is a lot of people, I'm like, you should have fun. You should give yourself treats. And they're like, I don't know how to have fun. Like, there's fun for the whole family. I'm like, but that might not be so fun for you. Or like, give yourself a healthy treat. I don't know what a healthy treat is. If it's not a glass of wine, what would it be? So what did you do for fun when you were 10 years old? Whether that was like walking in the woods with your dog or going fishing or making arts and crafts or coloring. That's often a clue for something that you would enjoy in the present or that you can tap into as an adult. And the other one, and this is a very uncomfortable question, but it's super helpful, is to say, whom do you envy? Because we don't like to feel envy. We often deny that we feel envious of people, but it's a huge flashing sign that somebody has something that you wish you had. And that can be really helpful. I remember talking to a friend of mine who said she was really saying kind of mean things about this coworker. Like, you know, all she does is talk about her trips. Like, she's just come back from a trip. She's going off to a trip. Like, she's planning her trip. She's just whatever. And I was like, you sound like you really envy her. And my friend was like, no, I don't. And then she was like, oh, you know what? Yes, I do. I love to travel and I haven't been on a trip in like 2 years. And nothing was stopping her. She had exactly the same job. This one woman was just doing it. And this coworker was just doing it. And then, and she had nothing stopping her other than just kind of the inertia of life. And she didn't have kids. She had plenty of money. She could, you know.
Yep.
It's like that envy was really helpful. You know, it was like a giant arrow pointing to something. But we don't like feeling envy. It's so painful.
Well, we're taught when we're little, right? Like, don't worry about what Joey's doing. Focus on yourself. But it's like, right. I love that idea. It's like, wait, but if there's something that I'm looking at that I admire or envy, it's like, what is that? Can I try to capture it instead of just feeling bad about myself?
What can I learn from it? What can I learn for myself? Like, if this looks really great, like, I envy the fact that this person gets to do lots of presentations in the job. Well, it turns out I'm a real ham and I would love to get up in front of an audience and perform and talk. Well, a lot of people don't want to do that. But that sounds like fun to you. It's like, well, probably you could find those opportunities. If you were like, you know what, this person is doing this and I feel like I'd like to do that. That would be fun. That would be fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so this is something I've been thinking about lately. And I just wanted to ask you, can you be happy if you're inauthentic? Like if you, number one.
Such a good question, right?
If you fail to be Gretchen for a day, right? And you're just inauthentic for the day, are you able to have happiness?
For a day? Yes. But what if I'm a doctor because both my parents were doctors and I was really good at science as a kid and everybody's like, you should be a doctor. And so I became a doctor and now I'm a doctor and I've been a doctor for 10 years. But I would really rather be doing something else. I don't know. I think for some people it would be very difficult and maybe explosive. You know, they wouldn't be able to sustain it. And then for other people, I don't know. Or in other situations. And sometimes you do something that is not important to you because it's important to somebody else. Like, you know, my family was arguing about whether to get a dog and I was the holdout. I was like, I don't want the inconvenience of a dog. And I got a dog because it was really important to everybody else. And now I love having a dog. So I'm glad I did it. But even if I didn't really, I know people who really don't like having a dog, but they do it because it's important to somebody else. So sometimes that's part of love. But like getting a dog is different from being a doctor for your whole life or, you know. This comes up sometimes with where you live. You know, it's sometimes hard. You can't compromise. It's like, you want to live in Los Angeles. I want to live in New York. It's not like we can live in Chicago and both of us be happy. it's like, that's a hard situation to manage. If you're just like, the thing is, I just, I mean, it's hard. There are things where it's, but I mean, to your point about, I think the more articulate you are and the more you are explicit about your trade-offs, the more at peace you can be. It's when you're in denial about it. Like, I can be happy anywhere. It's like, what? Because, I mean, it's, I think it's always surface these things, be conscious of them, because then you can think them through. It's when they are subterranean, you know, and unacknowledged or even like shamefully denied. Then they, well, Carl Jung has that great thing about whatever you deny, like comes back and comes right back at you, right? Except he says it in this beautiful Carl Jung way, which is basically like that stuff that you repress is going to, it's going to come out.
Mm-hmm. What I hear you saying is if you're clear about what matters to you and you prioritize it, sometimes you can give up on some of it if it's in the name of family or love, but you kind of have to watch where that line is.
Well, because sometimes we want things that are incompatible. Like you can't both have a clean, comfortable, tidy house and come home and flop down on the sofa every night after work. They're both have value. They're both good, but they're kind of incompatible. Mm-hmm. Like, so, but when you are articulating what it is that you want, you know, sometimes people make a false choice. Well, I can have a life of financial security and stability, or I can live a life of true passion where I'm following my dreams and doing what I really enjoy. It's like, well, you know, is it really a life of sterility and boredom and financial security, or a life of deep? I mean, it's like maybe there's a way to you right. can like have a little bit of both.
Right.
You know, I think sometimes we don't want to admit that we want to force a choice by pretending like there's only two things to choose from. Yep. Where usually the world is complicated, but that's painful to think about.
It is painful, and that there's more compromise than just, you know, I set out to find authenticity and I was like, and when I get there, it'll be like a beach vacation. And it's like, no. You can, like, I love what I do now, and it's like deep passion, but you know, there's still a lot of things I don't want to do, and it's, you know, it's a trade-off. There's a lot of compromises you still have to make. And so it's not about just being in a bliss state all the time.
And also, I think the thing about authenticity is that it can be very sad, because I think to admit who you are is to admit all the things that you are not. And sometimes that makes you feel sad. Like, I remember I wrote a blog post about this, and I said something like, it makes me sad that I never want to go to a jazz club at midnight. And somebody wrote on my blog, oh, Gretchen, you live in New York City. You could totally go to a jazz club at midnight. I'm like, that's what makes me sad. I could literally go to a jazz club at midnight every single night of my life. What makes me sad is that I don't want to go. Uh-huh. I wish I wanted to go, but I don't want to go. I wish I loved food. People get so much fun out of food. I'm not interested in food. I don't really like music, not only jazz. I like a song here and there, but I'm just not passionate about music. I see how much pleasure people get out of it. But, you know, and so it's sad because you have to admit, like, that you have limitations and that you have your faults that you are going to fight over. And it's funny because on the podcast, Alyssa and I talk about demerits, like when we give ourselves a demerit for, like, making a happiness fail. And we've been doing it for 2 years. And what's happening is that you're starting to see demerits come up multiple times. Because we're just messing up in the same way. It's like, here I am losing my temper, flying off the handle for no good reason again.
Right.
You know, that's what I have to worry about. That's like what I constantly am trying to manage, which is my tendency to do that. So
it's really about self-acceptance.
Yes, yeah. I think it is. I think it really. And the fact is, accepting yourself doesn't mean you can accept yourself and expect more from yourself. So I don't think accepting yourself implies complacency or that there's no place to grow. I think what it means is just saying, like, I'm not going to fundamentally be a different person. I did an interview with a very well-known science writer and health writer, reporter. And she said to me, well, you know, she had struggled a lot with exercise and wanting to exercise more. And I was talking about this and that and the other thing and trying to kind of like what I would think she would do. And she goes, but the thing is, Gretchen, I don't want to do that. I want to be the kind of person who like loves to get up and like go for an hour run, or like who really like loves to train for the marathon, or like go on these long bike rides. And I'm just like, you're not that person. Like, that is not, no. I mean, that is a big waste of your time.
I love this.
You're not that person. So find a way to achieve your aim in a way that's consistent with like the basic boundaries of your personality. And just a fantasy of 100% transformation is just like, it's just going to lead you to disappointment. And then you're not doing anything because you're like, well, you know, one day I'm going to wake up and be that person. It's like, well, unlikely, you know. Back to the tendencies, somebody was married to Rebel. And she's like, well, I've been married to him for 15 years. And I really have a problem with you suggesting that he's not going to change. Because I really think like one day a person grows up and realizes that an adult can't live their life that way, just doing what they want all the time. And I'm like, Well, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but he's a grown up. You've been married to him for 15 years. Like, no, I don't think he's like, adults can live that way and they do live that way. And that is your husband. And that is, I mean, he's not going to outgrow it one day. This right. is who he is. I mean, he could learn, he can, you know, it's not like he can't grow. But to say like one day he's going to be like, you know what, honey, I realize I've really been neglecting my adult responsibilities. I'm just going to turn over a new leaf and be a completely different kind of person. I'm like, I've never seen that happen.
Right, right. So I mean, Gretchen, I love it. I love the messages. It's just one big be yourself and let go of the judgments and, you know, like just own it and figure it out. I've been thinking about this new project lately called The Manual of Me. Like, what if we were born with a manual that told us like, these are my tendencies, like, right? Like, this is who yeah. I am. And then yeah. once you kind of know that, you know, if we were like, think of cars, this car, you know, needs to get yeah. out on the highway and drive certain miles. This one doesn't, right? And you kind of deal with what you have. And it doesn't mean that there's necessary limitations, but there's definite, you know, situations where a truck is more helpful yes. than that Ferrari. But everybody's like, I want to be the Ferrari. And it's like, well, right. you know, I also want to be like 5'11", but I'm 5'4". So, you know, yeah.
No, but I mean, one of the things I would say is like, treat yourself like a toddler. You know, Gretchen can't take the cold, so she can't be out too long. Or Gretchen gets really crabby when she hasn't eaten, so she can't go, she can't eat dinner too late. You know, it's right. again, like, what's the manual of me? Yes, I love that idea. I love that idea. I want to like fill out the manual of me.
Awesome. I hear a collaboration in our future. Yeah, I was just thinking like, what if you, like, you know, what were your interests? What were your hobbies? I have blue eyes. I have blonde hair. I'm a certain height. And then you just keep going, your interests. And then like, you're, to your point, I think it's not a small idea to say, you know, I wish I loved mm-hmm. traveling around the world. I think people who say they're super adventuresome that way sounds amazing. I just don't like it, you know?
Neither.
And so you're just owning these things and, you know, big events like conference events and hotels. I feel like I'm going to die in those things. I can't stand them. So, you know, just being more honest with yourself that this is how it is. And as an author, one of the big things, right, is to get out there and do lectures. It's not my favorite medium, right? So I don't know. It's a lot easier if you can ratchet off, accept the parts that you do like and focus on those more.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Know yourself.
Know yourself.
It's the oldest advice in the world because Temple of Apollo at Delphi, know thyself. And it's, we're still talking about it because it's true.
It's true. It's true. Well, Gretchen, thank you so much. So much incredible information for anybody out there looking to follow up. You can jump on Gretchen Rubin's website, gretchenrubin.com. She's got the quiz. It definitely takes a couple minutes. You guys should all take it. Her links to her books are on there. They'll also be on my website. Thank you again for coming on today's show.
Oh, thank you. It was so fun to talk to you.